Good morning, Your Honors. Frank Weiser on behalf of the appellant, Dr. Shah. I don't want to digress. I'm going to get to the main argument, but just the procedural history of this case is so convoluted. And it reminds me of Gregory Chaitin, a noted mathematician who's involved in digital, what they call the field of non-Pythagorean neo-Pythagorean mathematics. I saw it on YouTube the other day. But he talks about in the area of digital physics or digital philosophy, there's a question of how physicists measure entropy in a black hole. And when I heard that, I thought about this case. I did not litigate this at the trial level, as the court may know. But when I took it up on appeal here, I concentrated mainly on the claims that I thought did have some merit. And the issue I would like to first address is the issue of attorney's fees. As the court may know, the district court dismissed Dr. Shah's claims on a motion for summary judgment by the county, and it did so on both the first, second, and fifth remaining claims. Those were claims that had remained after the court had dismissed the other claims in the third amended complaint based on a motion to dismiss. And the district court did so both on procedural bars, statute of limitations grounds, and also found on the merits that there was no evidence to support Dr. Shah's claims. I have submitted, both in my brief and in a FRAP 28J letter that I submitted to the court the other day, I have argued that if, in fact, the court had dismissed it on procedural grounds on a statute of limitations basis, even if it had reached the merits, it still was not a ground for attorney's fees under federal law, both under Title VII, 42 U.S.C. 1981 or 42 U.S.C. 1988 for the 1983 claim. And that would apply also to the 1981 claim. And the reason is this circuit has held, and I cited a case, Branson v. Knott, and I also cited in the FRAP 28J letter a case recently decided by Judge, I believe Judge O'Scanlan, authored the opinion Klamath, Siskiyou Wildlife versus U.S. Department of Land, that for a prevailing party status under federal law, and that's applied consistently throughout the United States Code, if a case is dismissed on procedural grounds, the court never gets to the constitutional claims. It cannot award any relief on the merits. Now, in that case, the Klamath case, it was the plaintiff who was not awarded his attorney's fees, even though a court had, as I understood it, determined that there was merit to the claims. But in this case, I would argue that it's a reciprocal basis. If, in fact, this case was barred by statute of limitations, even though the district court found that there was no merit to the claims, the statute of limitations bars would have prevented the court from awarding Dr. Shah any award, even if he had the best claims in the world, and if he couldn't get any kind of relief on the merits because of the statutory bar, then I would argue the defendants cannot get any relief based on the statutory bar. It's the same procedural limitation. And the Branson case is very clear.
I guess I'm not understanding the reasoning there. The district court found the claims were vexatious and frivolous, right? And on that basis, awarded attorney's fees.
Correct.
I don't understand why it is that precludes. And in fact, some of those claims you haven't even appealed. So it sort of tends to suggest the district court may have been right about that. At least you could see that the district court was right about that.
Well, it's my understanding, I mean, the district court order on the attorney's fees was not at all clear. I thought it was very cryptic. It was only a one-line basis that there was long history of litigation, and therefore it found in favor of the defendants on the attorney's fees. It's not clear, number one, on what statutory grounds the district court found it. And number two, looking back on the order dismissing summary judgment, in favor of summary judgment, it found both on, in the alternative, on procedural grounds and on the merits. And my argument is this circuit certainly holds that if it's a procedural limitation, even if you have the most frivolous case in the world, you cannot award fees under 42 U.S.C. 1988. That's what the Branson case says explicitly.
It doesn't really?
Pardon me?
Does it really?
I'm sorry.
Does it really?
Yes, it does. Branson.
So if you bring a claim that's procedurally barred, but substantively frivolous.
Absolutely. Branson was a case in which the district court found that the case was frivolous and without merit, and this court found, the circuit found that it didn't matter. It could be, in fact, the most frivolous case in the world, but it's a procedural limitation, and it's therefore not a prevailing party on the merits.
Branson was a case where we found no subject matter jurisdiction, right?
I'm having trouble hearing.
No subject matter jurisdiction.
Those.
No subject matter jurisdiction.
Yes, I understand that, but it's
not just any old procedural bar. It is no subject matter jurisdiction, and maybe that if there's no subject matter jurisdiction, then there's nothing the court can do. I'm not sure that's what it says, but that has some semblance of plausibility.
I don't think it's just the jurisdictional issue that's the basis there. As I understand Branson, it talked in the alternative, one that the court didn't have jurisdiction and one that it didn't matter. It was not a prevailing, because of the procedural limitation, it was not a prevailing party on the merits. And that's, I think, the key under 42 U.S.C. 1988. But even if that be the case in reading Branson just on its four corners.
No, it's very clear what it says. It says, look, I'm looking at Branson right now, page 293, and what it says is the district court said it had no subject matter jurisdiction over a 1983 claim, and 1988 is the attorney's fee statute for claims under 1983. And therefore, since there's no subject matter jurisdiction to award substantive relief, the applicable attorney's fee statute, which is also under the same ground of jurisdiction, can't operate as a source of power for the court to grant attorney's fees. Why? Because the court has no subject matter jurisdiction over that statute. It certainly did not say that any kind of procedural dismissal would preclude attorney's fees, and it certainly did not say that the district court didn't have authority under its inherent power or some other authority to grant sanctions.
Well, I would respectfully differ with Your Honor's interpretation of Branson, because I believe in my opening brief at page 18, I cited Branson fully where it said there were two alternative grounds why it was not able to award attorney's fees. The first ground is, as the court says, as Your Honor says, because it lacks jurisdiction. But then Branson clearly stated at 62 F3rd of 293, in the alternative, the circuit had held, even if the district court had the jurisdiction to impose 1988 fees, whereas here dismissal was mandated for lack of jurisdiction, the defendant is not a prevailing party on the merits within the meeting. So I think the court considered the Branson case clearly says there it's both jurisdiction and, because it's a procedural limitation, it's not ruling on the merits.
I read those two things as meaning exactly the same thing. You can't be a prevailing party under a statute over which the court has no jurisdiction. Since the court has no authority over the statute, you can't be a prevailing party.
Well, I read Branson. I mean, it clearly states in the subjunctive, in the alternative. I mean, why would Branson have to give two different reasons for it? If it was purely just a jurisdictional issue, then the court would not have to get to the issue of prevailing party.
Well, it's because I wasn't that choice law clerk at the time.
But counsel, let me ask you a question. There's not much time left. I couldn't find a statement of facts in your brief, and I didn't see any citations to the record. You wrote the blue brief, right?
Yes, I did. And I need to indicate to the court, I didn't file a reply brief, as the court may know. I had toxic megacolon in December, 1 month after I filed this brief. The opening brief, I had to rush me to see the
sign. Well, the reason I raised the question is because your opposing counsel has raised the question as to whether or not you complied with our rules.
I believe I did, Your Honor, and in the opening brief, I saw a statement of facts, statement of the case, at pages 3 through 5, and I made reference to the record and made reference in specific in the issues, the facts, the undisputed facts of the district court order. In other words,
And where do you do that in your brief?
Pardon me?
Where in your brief?
In page 3 to 5, but in particular page 4.
I'm looking at page 4.
Page 4 of my opening brief at, I make reference to the excerpts of record, volume 3, page 767, lines 4 through 6. Then at page 5, I make reference to volume 3, page 773, lines 2 to 14, volume 1, page 124 to 291, volume 3, page 638, 754, and 762, 76.
Well, the first one is the district court's order.
And that is the order that I'm...
Right, but that's not the same as citing to the record, citing the court below. Are there any citations in your brief to something other than the...
Yes, I have volume 1, which was the opposition, the opposition to the motion for summary judgment filed by Dr. Shaw, pages 124 to 291.
And where do you sign this?
Page 5, at the beginning at the top.
ER volume 1, and you cite a swatch of 150 pages. That's your citation of the record?
Well,
a block of 150 pages?
Well, the point was, Your Honor, my argument was more a question of a pure question of law. On the issue of the merits, what I was arguing based on the First Amendment claim is that there is no evidence in the record to support the motion for summary judgment based on the petitioning claim. And the argument was is that the district court order clearly recognized that Dr. Shaw had filed a suit in state court against the county, had lost sometime in late 2005, and he had a First Amendment claim based on petitioning activity, and including his free speech claim, and the county never raised that in their initial motion for summary judgment. So under this circuit's precedent of Nissan Fire, the burden was on the county to initially make the production on that claim, on that issue. And that's simply not in the record. It's not even contingent.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is Cindy Tobesman. I'm here for the county. The Court seems to amply understand the prevailing party issue, and so I will not belabor the point, except to point out that the Klamath case, which opposing counsel has mentioned in his 28J letter, specifically states that, this is at 589 F3rd at 1033, the case was dismissed for lack of jurisdiction, both on the ground that Klamath's claims had become either unripe or moot. Both defects indicate the absence of a constitutional claim or controversy because a claim cannot grant any relief. It's not surprising that where you lack subject matter jurisdiction, you can't award prevailing party attorney's fees. That's not this case. The Court, I think, in noting the defect in his argument points to the broader problem with this case, and that is it is frivolous beginning to end.
Well, on the frivolous point, I have a little bit of difficulty with page 800 of the record, which I assume is the basis upon which you would argue that the Court made a finding of frivolousness. Is that right?
I'm familiar. What is the page?
Well, if you look at the judgment to which is attached the civil minutes, and I'm looking at page 800 of the record. Do you have your
copy? I don't
copy?
Have it in front of me. I apologize.
Well, it's lower part of the page, defendant's motion for attorney's fees. And And normally one would look for a finding. I hereby find that this case was brought with frivolousness, it's vexatious, it fails to do this and that. Let me rephrase the question. What is the basis upon which you find or that the district court found that this case was frivolous?
The court says that in light of the protracted nature of the litigation, the fact that
Well, wait, stop there.
I'm sorry.
That's not enough, is it?
No, not the protracted nature, but the fact that he attempts to reassert claims alleged in prior federal and state court cases. In other words,
is that enough by itself?
Well, I think if you know that you're asserting claims that are stale or barred by res judicata or collateral estoppel, that should do the trick. I mean, that's akin to, you know, finding out on discovery that you just don't have any basis to your claims and going forward anyway. If you know your claims are barred by res judicata and collateral estoppel because you brought the identical claims over and over again for 15 years, you know you're putting the other party out and forcing them to spend a lot of money defending against a claim that isn't going to get out of the box.
And what about the last part?
And the unreasonableness of plaintiff's claims in the instant lawsuit. I think the unreasonableness encompasses the fact that...
But is that the same as frivolous?
Well, I think unreasonableness in the context of this case means exactly that. I mean, if you read in context of the rest of the district court's decision, the district court discusses the fact that Dr. Shaw concedes he never heard a racist comment from anybody. He never, during the period of time that he says he was passed over for promotion, he concedes he needed to apply for a promotion, get a promotion. He hasn't applied since 1995.
Okay, and what's the statutory basis upon which he is denying the motion for attorney's fees?
I don't know that the court recites the specific statutory basis, but there are a number of bases alleged.
I couldn't find that court did.
Yeah, I don't think that the court specifically calls it out, but there are a number of bases, and as Judge Kaczynski has pointed out, he didn't appeal numerous of the district court's rulings on that basis alone to affirm the award of attorney's fees in this case. I mean, it's sustainable on multiple grounds.
The failure to appeal a ground is a basis for inferring frivolousness?
Well, no, but the court found, well, in this case, the court found that they were barred by res judicata and collateral estoppel. It found that the claims were unreasonable. In other words, they have been alleged, realleged. They are the same. There's not one shred of evidence.
In the absence of a statutory reference by the trial court, what is your theory under which attorney's fees can be granted?
Well, I think that it can be granted under multiple grounds. I mean, Section 1988.
Give me one, and then we'll go from there.
Sure. I think that Section 1988 clearly permits it. The court's allowed to grant attorney's fees in its discretion. And one of the bases for doing so is to protect defendants from burdensome litigation having no legal or factual basis. I think this case fits that definition to a T.
All right. And there's no – and it's purely discretionary. There's no – is there any yardstick that we should be applying?
I think that it is in well within the district court's discretion after, you know, being the one to sit and listen to the evidence, or in this case, the lack of any evidence, to exercise its discretion as it sees fit. I mean, and I would urge this court to consider awarding appellate fees. I mean, opposing counsel has made the one argument that I believe, you know, apparently he believes is the meritorious argument that he had, and it is on its face patently frivolous. There's no basis for it.
And have you sought that in your brief?
We did, the last section of our brief.
And what's the basis for appellate fees?
Is it Section 1988 also permits.
1988 also?
Correct.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I believe you're out of time. If you'd like to take a minute for a bottle in the house.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just mention that the district court order did not find, it seems to me there are so many multiple grounds there. Some of the grounds were on procedural limitations, but even the grounds on the merits was not on collateral estoppel or res judicata. What the court considered was evidentiary grounds, saying there was just no evidence to support Dr. Shaw's claims. So it seems to me it does not seem to me obvious that Dr. Shaw's claims failed as a matter of law for purposes of 1988 fees or the reciprocal federal fees. And without the court, the district court, indicating what the statutory basis or which of the claims it was finding the basis for the fees, I find it hard to see how it could uphold its order.
Well, so Section 1980, sorry.
Judge Gould with a question, please.
Yes, Your Honor.
How long has Dr. Shaw been litigating the underlying claims in one forum or another?
Well, I think he has been litigating with the county since, I believe, sometime in 1991 or 92.
Okay, so on your theory about attorney's fees, if he were tomorrow to file a new 1983 suit, and that in turn was again dismissed, would you say there never can be an award of fees against him?
No. I said that the basis of the district court order, as I understand it, reading the order, is that there were various grounds, some procedural and also on the merits, but the merits did not necessarily include collateral estoppel or res judicata. The district court considered claims that Dr. Shaw had of evidence that he claimed that occurred after the operative date of the statute of limitations, sometimes in 2007 and 2008. It wasn't going back and looking just to the previous pattern. It was also that he had no evidence in that time period that would have been timely. And even if given that would all be prior history. The question would be, what was the basis of his claim during the time that he could have filed the claim without the statutory bar? I might add, Your Honor, that in my FRAP 28J letter, I attached a written settlement agreement that Dr. Shaw that we entered into on appeal through the mediation offices, in which this litigation would have been dismissed. Dr. Shaw would have not had to pay the attorney's fees and actually would have received a settlement from the county. It was signed by me, Dr. Shaw, county counsel.
Is that operative?
Pardon?
Is that operative?
In other words,
is there a settlement?
Well, what happened is, and county counsel is here, we are still talking about that. We signed a settlement agreement. The operative term of the agreement was Dr. Shaw was to retire by March 22, 2009, or when he got a settlement check, whichever came first. Which you understood is they would approve it, March 26th would come along, or he'd get the settlement check before he'd retire. March 26, 2009 came around, he retired. We were told the county couldn't schedule the hearing until after that. So we said, fine, we had to comply with the agreement. He retired, and then the board rejected it.
And, so there is no settlement.
Well, what we did was we made an offer without reserving our rights that to even take less money. It was rejected. And then we went back into district court. Dr. Shaw, and it was in the settlement agreement, had filed a suit in 2008. I was not part of that. And had not served the county. And in the settlement agreement, it said that suit would be dismissed as part of the settlement. Well, after the county, the board rejected the agreement, he went ahead and served it. And it also had these claims going back to that general time period. At that point, the county then made another motion, was sent to Judge Wilson, made a motion to declare him a vexatious litigant, which Judge Wilson refused to do. And said just because he had this history of litigating didn't make him a vexatious litigant. It was then transferred to Judge Snyder again as a related case. I then substituted in and limited his claims only to the settlement agreement and trying to enforce the agreement under 42 U.S.C. 1983. My theory is, that at least there are certain cases where contract rights in this circuit are recognized as a statutory entitlement subject to due process protection.
Is that issue before us right now or
no? No, it is. I apologize. What the court had asked me, Dr. Shaw is not litigating anything any further other than he would like to enforce the settlement agreement. He would have liked to have dismissed this action had that agreement gone through.
Okay, but I hear you as saying there is no operative settlement agreement that would affect this case.
We've appealed the dismissal. The district court dismissed Dr. Shah's claim to enforce the settlement agreement, saying it didn't rise to constitutional significance. We've appealed it. If it, in fact, is upheld.
But is that appeal? That appeal is not before this panel.
No, it is not. It was just filed. No, it is not.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is argued. We'll stand some minutes.